out there, oh, a peace is calling in the bonds of love we meet for the world anew.
Welcome to Muffin Talk.
Kia ora and welcome to Muffin Talk, brought to you by the initiative Titi Paunamu, Study and Joy. Muffin Talk is a weekly radio program to which I invite guests to talk about their work and their passion for issues on community programs, social justice, interfaith, Bible studies, or the Catholic Church. My interviews are done in the studio of Planet FM or via Zoom. Today's session is a collection of snippets of interviews recorded during the year 2020. I hope you enjoy the variety of interview guests. Their names will be on the website of Titi Paunamu, Study and Joy. Here go the recordings.
NSREF in New Zealand began about 2011. Just a small group of us in Auckland. And there are three groups now, Auckland, Wellington and Dunedin. And our work is to draw attention to the problem of trafficking in human beings, slavery in the world today. Slavery was abolished a couple of hundred years ago, but today there are around about 40 million slaves in the world. And our work, as we see it, is to raise consciousness, to educate about this reality, which also exists in New Zealand, and also to work on prevention and some advocacy with the government.
But what is a slave in today's definition?
Well, there are different kinds of slavery today. There is sex slavery for commercial sex, forced labor, child soldiers, trafficking of people for organ removal, forced marriage.
So when you say trafficking for organ removal, does that mean you abduct somebody because he or she has organs that you need?
Yes. Yes, and organs are very precious. As you know, people need kidney transplants and heart transplants and other kinds of transplants. And these, apparently, these organs can be sold.
What is the difference between an Islamic center and a mosque?
I think firstly, let's look at the wording itself. So in we refer to it as masjid. Masjid means a place of prostration. It's a very sacred, a sacred word itself, because it's a place where we put down our head in front of our Creator. So, preferably, we try not to use the word mosque. It's a loose term. The connotations sometimes are not so too savory or not too nice. Some people take umbrage to the use of the word mosque. Nevertheless, so masjid or mosque versus just a center, or in other terms, we sometimes would call it a musalla in Arabic. Musalla means a place, a convenient place for congregation. So some of the differences between a center or in a masjid or a mosque is, number one, it's the prayer space is defined. Prayer space is defined. The area must be one that is physically and spiritually pure and clean. The land on which the mosque resides or the mosque stands, that land belongs to no one. That land is sort of purchased either by individuals or by the community at large, and then it's endowed in the name of the Almighty Allah. So it does not belong to any specific person or organization. Yes, you'll have trustees or you'll have members who have been appointed to manage the affairs of the mosque, and that's necessary, that's important. It doesn't specifically belong to anyone. In addition to that, the mosque cannot be moved. So, for example, this studio that we are sitting in, if we had to classify this as a mosque, we purchased this piece of land, we've endowed it in the name of Allah, in the name of the Almighty, then this cannot be moved. We can add to this, we can make additions, we can renovate, we can beautify, but we cannot move this about. We believe in Islam that the land on which the mosque or the masjid stands is very sacred. So from the bowels of the earth up to the heavens, that space that it occupies is sacred land. That's right from the bowels of the earth to up to the heavens. Added to that, in terms of basic laws and jurisprudence, a person who may be in menstruation or postnatal bleeding, likewise a person who's had conjugals with his wife. So there's certain terminologies that we use to which removes a person from a sort of a pure state, in inverted commas. So we would require to have a bath and clean ourselves before entering that mosque or that masjid.
The church documents talk about people's participation in the mass, and they talk about it being full, conscious and active. So yes, there is some responsibility there to be aware of what we are doing, a consciousness about what we do.
And how do the people get the training for this consciousness? Is that during your preparation for the sacrament?
It can be, but I think ideally what we would like to be doing, or what we'd like to see, is that this is an ongoing process in people's lives. It's not just learning something once or picking it up from one's parents or grandparents or what someone did a long time ago. It's something that we can be continually looking for formation for. We're really dealing with mystery here, and mystery can't be fully explored. Parishes will often ring us or email us with a particular request. I'm not sure if it's so much an obligation, but more a pathway, I think. Yes, it's a route we can take.
Yes. Is there a certain topic that is inquired most in most of all the workshops? Like, do you say more the training of ministers, or ministers of the Eucharist, or ministers of reading, or is it something different?
Probably mostly our requests would be for those who read and for those who are ministers of Holy Communion. They would be the two that we would have most. But we also get a steady stream of requests for Children's Liturgy of the Word. We also offer support for parishes for copyright. The copyright rules are not always well understood, and we can help parishes to make sure that they are meeting the copyright requirements.
Yeah, I think that's a big challenge, especially as many parishes don't use books, and you have to know how to put it up on the screens.
That's right. Yes.
And do you also have misunderstandings with the children's liturgy, that it's some people think that it might be more entertaining for the children, and others say we'll have the same reading but in different words?
Mm-hmm. Well, we like to think of it as children's liturgy. So yes, they do tend to have the same reading but in different words, have songs that the children can sing, have prayers that they can understand. So in an ideal world, I guess we don't think of it as entertainment. However, we don't want our children to be bored by it. We want them to be enlivened by it.
Can you tell us about Rav Ruza? I don't know if you're using it in your school.
We learn it. We use it in Jewish studies. It is when Jewish children or youth learn, or adults learn, in a yeshiva setting, which is the more text-based learning from the Torah.
Yeshiva
is like a religious learning center for just Judaic studies, so they are all around the world. We haven't got any in New Zealand, but it's a style of learning. So you might have a pair of either men or women learning together. They will take the same text, they will read that text, and they will analyze that text for themselves, and then they will share their opinion of that text, and they will look at it from a different angle. And each person gets a point of view without the other person running them down. So you might just reflect on the text in a slightly different way from your partner or from somebody else. So it has a deeper meaning and a deeper sort of analytical approach.
And is it always the same partner, or are you put together whenever it suits the teacher?
When I use it in the classroom setting, it's maybe the same partner, maybe different partners. it's good to mix it up.
Yes.
Yeah, so you have different opinions. But it's definitely a style of learning, and definitely not, you can have your argument, but you never talk up over the other person, and you never think the other person or your opinion is better than the other person. It just adds a different value to the text.
I grew up in an environment where faith was all around me, and in school, in the church, there was always this talk about missionary work, and that to do missionary work was a noble thing. So, and my mother was a very good influence. She was probably the model I followed. She gave money to the missions overseas. She had the troker a box there at Lent. She was always thinking of the people that were less well off, and she used to bring people into the house and welcome them and give them a cup of tea. So from the early age I saw charity, and she really embodied that faith, hope and charity, those cardinal virtues. And I had a desire then to, when I grew up, to do something abroad that I could help. And initially was use my carpentry skills, but I ended up discovering a volunteer program in India, and I got excited in anticipation that this could be an exciting experience. And that's what kind of, they were the kind of experiences that kind of led me towards missionary work. When you actually smell, hear and feel these people's poverty, it has a huge impact on you. And when I went there, that was one of the big things that I experienced there as a life-changing, how much we take for granted in the West, how much we take, you know, seeing people queue in the morning for milk at 4:30, how much we take for granted in the West. And it's not, it wasn't until I went there that I had a sense, my goodness, you know, I started asking questions, how come I wasn't born into such poverty? And there was this sense of gratitude for where I was. And then what I could bring to those people was what I'd learned from my mother, you know. And I started to work as a volunteer in the program that's Mother Teresa had, and she had a very simple philosophy: you did it to me. Whatever you do to the least of these people, you did it to me. You do it to Christ suffering in the poor, which was her whole sort of theology of the cross, the thirst of God in the poor.
So it was quite a culture shock to go to India in the first place. But then, in a way, you had some familiarity with the faith and with Mother Teresa and her way of approaching any problem, any challenge.
Yes. Yeah, she had a very simple, you know, she said, we're not here to fix everybody. We're just here to do small things with great love. She said, if everybody was to put a drop of love in the bucket, we would eventually fill the world with God's love. And we're called to be missionaries of God's love. She said, it's not about how much you do, but how much you put yourself into the doing of little acts of charity, giving a glass of water, washing somebody, feeding somebody, that you were attentive, you were present, that you were engaged with that particular person.
I find a lot of people live life fairly superficially. Like, I know with the demands of family and work, it's very easy to just go through the routines and respond to the demands. And often the inner life is not nourished, is not fed. And so my work is to help people to see that there really is a whole inner world, an inner life, which is very satisfying and nourishing. And when we nourish that, when we live in that inner place of peace and contentment ourselves, then all of the other stuff, including family and the business demands and the problems that we might have and the challenges, all of that falls into place. And a more specific way of saying this would be, the inner life is being, it is our relationship with God. It's our relationship with Jesus Christ. And I know in my own life that if I am living in desire for deeper relationship with Jesus Christ, then everything else falls into place. But there are times too when I get caught up with the busyness, whether it be of life as a priest or the other demands or expectations that surround me. When I get caught up in that too much and lose the sense that I am in relationship with Jesus and dependent on Jesus for everything, when I lose that, then everything seems to fall apart. So the aspect of my work that I enjoy most is working with people at that inner level. And it's just wonderful to see the almost immediate growth and delight in them when they discover that this whole inner life, which is sacred but also is quite secure, it doesn't have to be pushed about by all the demands and needs of family and work. when you come forward to communion, they say, place your hands, one cupped in the other, to make a throne for the Lord whom you are to receive. And I see these people who really would rather receive on the tongue, receiving with full welcome, dignity and desire for the Lord in a way that they find difficult, but they're willing to do this in the interests of greater health and safety of people. I'd have to say that I've received some letters at the National Liturgy Office since this new directive was implemented about receiving communion on the tongue, and some people are very, very upset and very angry about that. And what I've done sometimes is simply email them back saying, look, I'm free for a chat now. If you want to send your phone number, I can call you. And I've called some of these people, and they have been very angry at me, at the bishops. And then we started talking a bit more, and then they start talking about their grandson who's struggling with drugs, a completely different issue. And at the end of the conversation, they have some peace. Like, people often just need to be heard. They just need to be listened to. And sometimes the issue that presents as their major fear or issue is really not their prime concern at all. Now, sadly, I'm not able to respond to every letter that the National Liturgy Office receives with a phone call. But it does go to show that if we do see people being particularly upset about these restrictions that have rightly been introduced, it may be just giving them some time, you know, listening to what are their real concerns.
You have the fascinating account of the serpent that slithers into the story. Now, it's fascinating that Eve is the only one that does any talking. And she really is a very good theologian. When the serpent says that, you're told not to eat the fruit, and then says, but if you eat the fruit, you'll eat and you have knowledge. You'll be like God, knowing good and evil. Honestly, Eve gets terrible press out of all of this, but she's the seeker of knowledge. I mean, had we stayed in the garden in the story, we would have been perpetually having to be good. Right? I mean, where does free will come in? And we find that Eve actually does a very good thing too when she tells the serpent that we're not to eat from the fruit of the tree, nor are we to touch it. She adds that bit in. She puts a fence around the law so it won't, you know, this is something Jews really love, put a fence around the law. And then, of course, she sees, she likes, and she takes the fruit. Now, she gives some to her husband, and there's a little piece right beside that. Who was with her? I really love emphasizing that piece because he's standing there right beside her, saying nothing. And, he is as guilty as she is. And, you know, we really get influenced by Augustine and Milton. Augustine gives us original sin and the fall. And we actually still call it Adam's sin, not Eve's sin. It's Adam's sin. Augustine even said if Adam hadn't eaten the fruit, well, we'd still be in the garden. But the interesting thing about this whole account is that it never comes back into the Bible, into the Old Testament.
Well, God's asked us to love our neighbour. Love God and love your neighbour. Like, it's very clear, you know, these are the main teachings of Christ. And our neighbours are people of all faith, of all backgrounds, of faith, not of faith, of everything. And how do we love someone if we don't know them? And so it's all very well to say, well, I love you, but if I've never met you and I know nothing about you, I may be offending you, or I may be, you know, like, I'm just not really actively loving someone if I don't know them. So I sort of felt called that, you know, I feel God is calling me, at least in my spiritual path, to get to know my brothers and sisters of other faiths. I don't have to believe exactly what they believe, but I can see a lot of goodness. There's parts of their religions, of all religions that I've encountered, that there's really deep beauty in everything. And I don't accept everything that they may teach, but I don't see any reason why I can't accept the beauty which they have. And yeah, often it's inspired me to become, you know, to want to learn more deeply about my own faith and to sort of maybe take up some spiritual practices which I had let go by. Like, you get really inspired, like Hindus do really devout fasting. You know, like many, not every Hindu obviously, but I've met many Hindu people. Some of them go one day of every week without food or water for a whole 24 hours. And I'm like, well, like, I've never done that in my life, you know? And then obviously our Muslim brothers and sisters do a very devout fast right through Ramadan. And then I was thinking about our, you know, it inspired me, like, we've got our own Lenten practices, and is there benefit in me doing a more devout sort of time of prayer and almsgiving and fasting and everything.
I arrived in New Zealand March 17th, and the government closed, you know, the border in March 19th. So my obligation when I came here is just to keep in my room and no contact with the people, you know, from my area. Okay, it's okay. 2 weeks. Amazing. So I start my quarantine because I come in from Australia, and in my, I think, 7th or 8th day, the government say, okay, now all New Zealand is in level 4. So I was in lockdown. I prefer to say lockdown because quarantine, you know what I mean, quarantine?
Yes.
It's coming from 40. So it's 40 days.
Yes.
So this one was more, I think, more than 40 days. I think the total lockdown in New Zealand, whatever. So I came here, and in my 7 or 8 days of my quarantine, my own quarantine or lockdown, the government say, so sorry, but now we are in level 4, blah, alarm, on the cell phone, blah, blah. And I have to stay here. But if you want, I can answer from my heart. I feel very lucky, you know, to came here. Many people, you know, told me, so sorry, Father Alec, you came here for lockdown. I say, well, believe me, I feel very lucky, because if I had to stay in Alice Springs, for example, I was there like a priest, but was not my assignment. And the majority of my stuff, you know, my clothes, especially, you know, winter clothes, was here in New Zealand because I sent this one before. So it was very crazy. If I had to stay in Alice Springs, I am priest, but my assignment is in New Zealand. So
your clothes are here.
I could just, yeah. So I could just, you know, celebrate mass and that's it, you know. And you know how I am. I really like, you know, to start, you know, with new activity, compromise, you know, myself with this activity. So just to stay in Alice Springs, I have beautiful and amazing experience in Alice. But just to stay there, you celebrate mass, you know, and then, you know, lockdown in Alice. No, I feel very lucky.
The gracious German theologian of the 20th century, Karl Rahner, professor in the University of Freiburg. He died as a man of 80 in 1984. And the theme that runs through his writings is the need to find a common ground between the situation of humanity, particularly humanity as he encountered it in Germany, and the fears and aspirations of people and the desperation of people in Germany. He's to seek a common ground that will allow him to talk meaningfully about the Christ within his society. And so again, we think of Karl Rahner today as, gosh, that guy who wrote all those big, very difficult to read books. But we forget that the ambition of Karl Rahner was actually to find a common language. Why worry about inclusive language in the liturgy? You know, so what? You know, God made the world. God is greater than gender. A lot of Catholics, even the very mention of the ordination of women. There are some places where actually these goals remind us just how we have to actually start checking our own theology. So it's not just a case of, oh, well, they're all just nice things and we can adopt them. They actually come back on us and say, hey, what the culture, these sustainable development goals, they cause me to actually ask myself awkward religious questions within my Christianity, within my Catholicism, within my whatever church one happens to belong to. So whenever one engages in dialogue, problem is it's never just, hey, I'm going to engage in dialogue. Let me just tell you everything I want to tell you. To engage in dialogue means that you tell me things as well.
We start as youngsters, as children, trying to understand the stories in the Bible, trying to understand what we're taught, trying to understand what on earth is going on in services in which we participate in. And as we become intellectually more curious, or we're tested in various ways through life, or we're exposed to new things, all these influences cause us, of course, wonderfully to learn, hopefully, to test, to challenge. So for me, there have been periods where that sense of journey or investigation has been more intense than others. And then there have been other periods which, in a sense, have felt more settled. All the way through this, I've been a Christian of the Anglican variety, trying to understand my spiritual relationship with God's creation, because this creation is our living earth, our living planet, which in turn is our life support system. We are incredibly, utterly dependent on all those other living forms on the planet for our survival. And yet, as human beings, we're doing a terrible job looking after the planet, when, in fact, the planet looks after us. And so that's a very big part of my spiritual journey these days. But also that flows through then into trying to understand, as I read the Bible, I seek an ecological interpretation, a creation interpretation there. And then also in worship, eco-liturgy is important to me.
Diwali is actually India's biggest and the most significant festival. And it is not celebrated just by Hindus. It is also celebrated by the Jains, Sikhs, and the Buddhists. So Diwali sees every household glowing under the light of lamps and fireworks as well. So it's a very pretty, colorful kind of a festival with friends and family paying each other's visits and giving gifts, particularly Indian sweets. So it is the brightest of all Hindu festivals. So these days you see like satellite images of India at night during Diwali. The significantly lit country.
In Acts it talks about the Messiah was the first to rise from the dead, and Paul's duty, his task was to proclaim light both to the Jewish people, our people, and to the Gentiles. And then, of course, the mission to those, go to whom I am sending you, to open their eyes so that they may turn from darkness to light, the opening of the eyes. So, yes, Paul is part of it all as well, but John seems to be the supremo of it all with these references to light. And there's so much. Well, of course, the classic line when Jesus says, I am the light of the world. And whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. And I'll tell you what, in John's gospel, where you have the word light, within a breath or two, you'll have the word life.
The real miracle of Hanukkah was the oil that lasted for 8 days, but it's also the light that lasted and the eternal light and this sense that in times of incredible darkness, when you feel, and I'm sure the Jews living in as slaves in Rome felt very down and out, that even the small guy has hope. And light symbolizes hope. It symbolizes even in your little corner, you can light your little candle, and it creates holiness in the space and time that you're at. And not only does that holiness just one light, but that holiness by doing it increases day by day. And so a lot of times we always think we burn a candle and the light goes out, but Hanukkah is counterintuitive. You burn the candle and every day the light gets bigger.
I wish you a wonderful year 2021. Let's hope and pray that the world will get over the pandemic. Please note that we will have a retreat day with Eamon Butler coming up in 2021. His online retreat day is on Who Am I? Reflecting on Our Identity in God. This Zoom event will be held on Saturday, the 30th of January, from 10:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. All events are on my website at www.studyjoy.nz. And for more information and registration, you can also send an email to info@studyjoy.nz. Kia kaha, keep safe, and Happy New Year.